from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, U.S. forces in Afghanistan have been warned of possible reprisal attacks following the killings of 10 civilians, nine of them children, allegedly by a lone U.S. serviceman. While the Obama administration says its war strategy in Afghanistan will remain intact, lack of trust on both sides complicates the future of the mission. We focus next on the ongoing crises in Afghanistan, including the recent horrific massacre of civilians allegedly by a U.S. soldier, and on the future of U.S. troop withdrawal. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Saturday, a killing spree took place in southern Afghanistan in a village 800 yards from a U.S. military base where 16 civilians, including women and children, were murdered by a 38-year-old staff sergeant, allegedly, an 11-year veteran with three tours in Iraq who is alleged by American officers to have acted alone. The killings, condemned by Afghan President Hamid Karzai, are under investigation and come in the wake of a burning of Korans last month on a U.S. base in Afghanistan, which caused rioting and took nearly 40 lives, including those of U.S. troops. U.S. Marines were also reported to have urinated on Taliban corpses, and the Taliban and its members have vowed to seek revenge for all of these recent acts, which also raises the question of how much President Obama's plans to wind down U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan is likely to move forward. This Forum Hour, we turn our attention once again to Afghanistan. Joining us is Stephen Biddle, who is Senior Fellow for Defense Policy with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Tamim Ansari, who is no stranger to Forum listeners, author and lecturer. His latest book is Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes, and welcome Tamim Ansari.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Glad to have you, and also glad to have Sean Parnell, who is with us, will be with us later on, a former U.S. Army Ranger. Let me go first, if I may, Stephen Biddle, to you. It would seem, in the wake of this latest incident, that there's even greater hatred of the occupation and more difficult dealing with the Taliban. Do you read it as such?
I think at the margin, those things are true. I think, to some extent, they were true already. Very few countries like foreign occupations, certainly Afghans don't. And yet Afghans, when surveyed, and they've been polled extensively since 2001, have supported the foreign occupation, not because they like it, which they clearly don't, but because they view it as standing between them and a future of either civil warfare or Taliban restoration, either of which they like even less. So I think Afghan public opinion towards the occupation, both before this incident and probably after it, is, I think, best characterized as highly ambivalent and deeply divided.
But just this morning, we should mention there was an attempt on the lives of both of President Karzai's brother. One Afghan soldier or one Afghan police officer was killed. And it would seem from this and other indications, Tommy Mansari, that things may be heating up again and the talks with the Taliban may indeed be interfered with as a result of this.
I don't know how the talks with the Taliban are going, but I have detected, you know, I talk with people in Kabul. I have some dealings with people there over some business things. And I've noticed over the last 6-7 months that even in Kabul, where people, their fate is pretty much tied up with the American presence, and it'll be greatly compromised once a withdrawal begins, or if there is the chaos after the withdrawal that many people think. Even those people are openly saying, gosh, you know, we wish the Americans would go away.
Do you think that, the massacring of 16 civilians will stir things up even more than the burning of Qurans, or is, from the perspective of Afghan people, that worse than the killing of civilians?
You know, I think from the Afghan perspective, the Quran thing is probably even more significant. I think that, you know, many of the much of the commentary about the Quran doesn't quite appreciate the feeling or the idea that people have about the Quran. They don't think of it as religious material. you know, to be lumped in with a commentary by a saint and the slippers of the prophet or something like that. The Quran is considered to be the actual uncreated emanation of God himself. It's kind of the way Christians feel, not about the Bible, but about Jesus Christ. So I think there's a sense of the cluelessness of the burning of the Quran and even the apologies and the further explanations that say, we're sorry, and then the conversation becomes about whether it was intentional or unintentional. And you can imagine that if somebody came to your house to babysit and incinerated your baby, the conversation centering on whether it was intentional would seem tasteless.
It would seem, in fact, that many Afghans believe that it was intentional, even though the American version of what happened with those Qurans was that it was accidental. And it would also seem that many Afghans believe that this was not one sergeant going berserk and acting by himself, but that there were others who were involved.
You know, I don't know about that, but I and they will investigate and they'll decide one way or the other, but I do feel like the accumulation of episodes suggests to me that in the rank and file, someplace in the American military presence there, there is a growing sort of a hatred of Afghans and correspondingly, on the Afghan side, hatred of Americans. And I wonder if it isn't the case with American soldiers that they go over there with the ideological rubric or the idea that we're there to help, and they experience themselves as coming to help Afghans. And there's no way to distinguish the Afghans we've come to help from from the Afghans we've come to fight. They look the same. They talk the same. They are the same. Some of them are cousins. And so the American troops' experience is, we've come to help you guys, and you're shooting at us, and you killed my brother. I wonder how we could change the circumstances so that the inevitable sort of deepening of hostility is ameliorated.
Well, let me go to Kabul. We have Laura Miller with us. She's Laura King, who is Afghanistan bureau chief with the Los Angeles Times, and she is in Kabul. And Laura King, glad to have you aboard here on Forum. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How deep is this hostility from both sides? Has it increased to a degree that may have even been unforeseen a while ago? And has the anger at the occupation increased as a result of, well, this massacre that took place?
Well, I think things really do seem to be at some kind of a low point, at least in recent memory of the last few years. Although this incident has not resulted in the kind of violent riots that we saw last month after the Quran burning incident at Bagram Air Base, there's still a lot of anger that can be felt.
This was, what happened actually was the irony that it was leading up to supposed talks with the Taliban. Where are we on that now?
Well, there had been some optimism that that relations between Washington and the government of President Karzai were improving somewhat after the Karzai government agreed to a transfer of prisoners being held in the U.S. detention facilities, and that had been a point of argument for some time. But now things seem to have reversed themselves again, and it does seem that there's quite a bit of tension at the moment between the American administration and Mr. Karzai.
And Laura King, again with us from Kabul, is Afghanistan bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Do the Afghans want the staff sergeant who's alleged to be singularly responsible for these killings to go on trial in an Afghan court?
There have been many calls for that from members of parliament, from local leaders in the district where these killings took place. But the U.S. military and the NATO force have been saying repeatedly that this particular soldier will be dealt with in the military justice system and not in Afghan courts, and that's going to be something that will be a source of upset here if that plan goes forward.
Could you also comment on what you think is the position presently of President Karzai? Just last week, for example, he endorsed this code of conduct, which means that husbands can beat wives and the sexes can be segregated. It almost seems like he's trying to reach out in those ways to the Taliban.
It does. I mean, he has taken a very conciliatory stance for quite some time now in an effort to bring the Taliban movement into talks. But they, on their part, have been scornful of Karzai and have indicated that they are willing to have contact with the United States, but leaving his government at this point out of the equation.
Laura King, again with us from Kabul, Afghanistan, Bureau Chief of the Los Angeles Times. And thank you so much for joining us, Laura King.
Thank you.
I'm going to go back to Stephen Biddle, who is Senior Fellow for Defense Policy with the Council on Foreign Relations, author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle. And Stephen Biddle, there have been calls for quicker withdrawal of troops. One of our local congresswomen, Zoe Lofgren, just earlier today, in fact, made that call. What kind of effect is all this having on the administration from your perspective?
Well, I mean, I think the underlying strategic merits of the war haven't changed very much here. What could change is the attitudes of key individuals as a function of whether or not they've reached their personal frustration threshold. And those two key individuals are obviously President Obama and President Karzai. To the extent that President Obama has not yet hit his frustration threshold, but believes more strongly than he did before that some sort of transition over to Afghan control ought to happen, and it ought to happen faster. He's got two different variables he can manipulate here, the troop count and the mission. Of the two, the troop count is harder for him to change because that's bound up in a series of negotiations we have with other allies in Afghanistan, all of whom face domestic political opposition to the war, and most of whom have taken substantial political risk themselves in order to announce that they're going to stay until 2014 because the United States is. To the extent that we announce significant increases in the speed of U.S. withdrawal from the country, we run the risk of leaving our allies politically exposed after they had taken these risks in order to align with us. So there may be some decision to accelerate the troop withdrawal, but my guess is it probably won't be dramatic. Where the president has more maneuver room is the mission that the U.S. troops in the country are performing. And in particular, there's been speculation that there would be an early transition from a combat mission into a training and advising mission that would be less casualty exposed.
Wasn't that something, in fact, that Secretary Panetta hinted at?
Yes, that's right. In a series of much commented remarks he made on an airplane on the way to Europe to a conference, he speculated that perhaps as early as sometime in 2013, the U.S. mission could change. The troops could stay, but if the mission changed in that way, in principle, they could spend a lot more time on base, a lot less time out patrolling, certainly none by ourselves, but even less with Afghans. And there might be some hope that that would reduce U.S. casualty exposure in the process, and that would be less bound up in these series of agreements we have with NATO and other allies.
Now, speaking about NATO and other allies, what do you anticipate is going to happen as a result, or can you forecast or give us a sense of what you think is likely meetings between President Obama and Prime Minister David Cameron, but also the G8 NATO meetings that are going to take place, the summits at Camp David?
Yeah, there's a lot of desire on the part of all the nations that are now involved in Afghanistan to do whatever they're going to do together. There's a lot of fear that if one or two major powers breaks with this agreement to stay until 2014 and then transition to Afghanistan, then everybody will head for the exits. There will be a race, and there will be a collapse, which all the governments involved will then be held responsible for. So my guess is that Prime Minister Cameron and President Obama are both going to be trying to solidify the unity of the Western position on the war. The cliche you hear all the time is in together, out together. My guess is they're going to be trying to prevent any defections from that coalition with a strong joint public statement.
And it's your sense, I believe, that the president is maybe spending a bit too moderately and only getting half the job done. Maybe he needed to listen to General McChrystal.
Well, I mean, the problem with this war, especially for the administration, is they feel we have important interests at stake, but they're moderate interests. This isn't World War II, but neither is it irrelevant to U.S. security. When they see real but modest interests at stake, what they want is some sort of moderate commitment that seems commensurate with what we have at stake to secure them. And the trouble is that moderate commitment that would work just doesn't exist. There's this famous quote from the old Prussian military philosopher Karl von Clausewitz: a short jump is surely easier than a long one, but no one trying to cross a deep chasm would begin by jumping halfway. I mean, war tends to encourage either big investment or no investment and disengagement. Moderation and sort of centrist reasonableness, which works so well in so many policy domains, is a very awkward fit to the conduct of war. So the administration has been stuck on that particular dilemma, where it looks to them like their choices are invest more than this is worth and have some chance of getting something, or invest less than it's worth and then get nothing. And that's a serious dilemma that's been hard for them ever since they've taken office.
Stephen Biddle with us again, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy with the Council on Foreign Relations. You can join us in this discussion. In fact, let me invite you to do that. We're talking about U.S. forces in Afghanistan having been warned of possible reprisal attacks following the killings of 16 civilians, 9 of them children, allegedly by a lone U.S. serviceman, and the Obama administration saying its war strategy in Afghanistan will remain intact, but lack of trust and greater hostility on both sides certainly complicates the future of the mission. Our toll-free number is available to you, and should you like to join this program, we cordially invite you to do that now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786, so feel free to join the program. Again, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite, you can join us on our toll-free number right now at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, our email address, simplyforum@kqed.org, or post any questions you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Or you can also communicate with us by going to our Facebook page. And Tamim Ansari, how serious should we be taking these threats that have been coming from the Taliban in terms of vengeance? And what does this do for the possibility of actually sitting down and having some serious or formidable talks with the Taliban?
Well, you know, there is no question that the Taliban would be carrying out reprisal and military activities whether or not this episode had happened, because there's a war going on. I don't think this makes things better or worse in that regard. I do think that ultimately, Afghanistan is a divided society, and the division goes back a long way. And I don't think that the way out is going to involve one side winning. The other side's never going to go away, and I think it's only a reconciliation of some sort. Not reconciliation exactly, but a forging of a national idea that's going to result in making Afghanistan governable. And for foreign powers, too, for us and for other outlying powers, the governability of Afghanistan is what's at issue here, not the conquest or defeat of Afghanistan. I think that in the big picture, the Taliban have an interest in being involved in some kind of negotiation with the other side of the Afghan fence. I don't think that their negotiation is absent the idea that any one of them or some, there's various contenders for who's going to emerge as the top leader of Afghanistan, not necessarily Karzai. So I think the negotiations have to be approached with open eyes. That's what the different parties want.
And we're talking with Afghanistan-born Tamim Ansari, author, lecturer. His latest book, Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. Let me go to our callers. And Margaret, you're first up here. Join us, please.
Hi there. I have a very simple question I've wondered about for a while. When we are ready to put a flag down at the end of its usable life cycle, we burn it respectfully, but also burning is a sign of animosity. What is the way that a devout Muslim would put away a Quran when it is no longer useful? I would have assumed burning. I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Tamim Ansari.
Well, as far as I know, the disposal of an old Quran has to be done with a ritual and reverence in the same way as the burial of a body. So burial is one of the ways that Qurans are disposed of. They can also be disposed of, I don't even like the word disposed of, but they can also be laid to rest or whatever in the water.
Like allegedly Mr. Bin Laden.
Yeah, now that you mention it. But I think, the attendant ritual, the kissing, the prayers and so on, is all part of the process of putting it away.
And more of your calls. Dave joins us. Dave, you're on forum. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm coming at this. I'm a Holocaust survivor's son, so I'm very, very aware and have been of times when war is necessary. And it's given me a really interesting, critical point of view in relation to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I know it's a very complex subject, but I'd be interested in terms of comments as to whether all the billions and billions spent, had they just been put back into our economy to make our nation strong as possible, maybe that would have had a much grander effect worldwide than all the damage we've done in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'd be interested in comments in regard to that, but also in regard to the necessity of war and whether we can't do a better job debating that in this country.
Well, that may be a big and in some ways almost unanswerable question for another day and for a whole hour of experts on war or not having war, pacifism. But what I'd like to go to the heart of that question, Stephen Biddle, with you is what do you see as the ongoing mission in Afghanistan? What is the purpose of American occupation at this point?
I think at this point the primary U.S. interest at stake, and therefore the primary U.S. mission, is to keep an Afghan collapse from destabilizing a region where there are already two active nuclear weapon powers, a witch's brew of Islamist militant groups, including but not limited to al-Qaeda's remaining global headquarters, and in which one of those two nuclear weapon states is in the midst of its own civil war against Islamist insurgents, and in which you could easily imagine that state, Pakistan, could tip into collapse if it loses that war, in which case that nuclear arsenal breaches containment and could fall into the hands of one or more of those Islamist militant groups within its borders. State collapse in Afghanistan, if it happens as a result of U.S. failure there, would add one more piece of hot charcoal to that mass of tinder. And that, I think, is why the administration feels that we do have real interests at stake. It implies that our mission, therefore, is the relatively minimal one, however, of preventing Afghan state collapse and chaos. Note that that falls a long way short of more ambitious agendas for nation building, economic development, and political development in the country.
But the war goes on in spite of the fact that al-Qaeda, the initial instigation for this war, has to some extent fled mainly to Pakistan. And Pakistan plays a more central role in terms of what I think the United States is concerned about vis-a-vis security, does it not?
I think for many years now, the primary U.S. stake in the region has been in Pakistan rather than in Afghanistan. The problem is our relationship with Pakistan ever since 2001, really, but especially since the Red Mosque was bombed or was occupied, has been so poisonous that our ability to affect outcomes in Pakistan by direct bilateral policy with Pakistan has been minimal. About our only chance of influencing for the better the situation in Pakistan is to prevent Afghanistan from making it worse.
Again, we're talking about Afghanistan this hour. You can join the program. Our toll-free number available to you is 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page, and we'll hear more from you. We'll also hear from a U.S. Army Ranger who is in 16 months combat in Afghanistan. All when we return on Forum, I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about U.S. forces in Afghanistan having been warned of possible reprisal attacks following the killings of 16 civilians, 9 of them children, allegedly by a lone U.S. serviceman. And in fact, earlier today, there were protests in the eastern part of Afghanistan, the first significant protest in response to the killings, and more concerns about a repeat of the wave of violent demonstrations that rocked the nation after the burning of the Qurans last month by troops at a U.S. base. The two brothers of President Karzai and other top Afghan officials in their delegation escaped in their cars unharmed from an ambush that happened earlier today as well. So there's ongoing news as we're trying to follow it. And we're talking about really not only all this ongoing news and the recent events that have all sort of catapulted into the news, the burning of the Qurans, the urinating on Taliban corpses, but the Obama administration saying that it will continue its war strategy in Afghanistan and will remain intact with that strategy. We spoke with Laura King, Afghanistan bureau chief for the LA Times. She was with us from Kabul. We have with us Stephen Biddle this morning, who is in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He's a senior fellow for defense policy for the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle. And Tommy Nanzari is with us as well, Afghanistan-born author and lecturer. And his latest book is Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. I wanted to bring Sean Parnell into this discussion, a former U.S. Army Ranger who spent 16 months in combat and the author of a book called Outlaw Platoon, Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan. And there are a number of things that I suppose are worth noting about Sean Parnell, before we even begin here. One of them is that they were embattled in, he was actually the commander of 40 men in an elite infantry platoon. And their task was to root out Pakistan-based insurgents from the mountain valley along Afghanistan's eastern frontier. There were 16 months of close combat, and over 80% of the men were wounded. And that's a casualty rate among the highest since Gettysburg. 350 of those insurgents were killed, but no civilians, which is pretty remarkable. Sean Parnell, good to have you with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
How did you avoid killing civilians?
Well, we really cared about the Afghan people. They were really important to us. Every mission we went on was a combat patrol, but it was also simultaneously a humanitarian one. We made it a point to load our Humvees not just with ammunition, but with coloring books for kids, medicine, warm clothing, food, water. And every time we went into a village, we brought the villagers those supplies because we wanted to show them that we really did care about them and their security and the well-being of their families. And I think that really, really helped us.
This is consistent with what many of the generals were saying American foreign policy ought to be in Afghanistan. That is, the troops on the ground should be trying to create better relations. And certainly what recently happened has set a great deal of that back. It must be pretty frustrating for you to read about.
Oh, it's really frustrating. It's really frustrating. And I think, in the wake of the unfortunate mistake of the Quran burnings, and now we have this massacre of civilians in Afghanistan, I think it's literally the worst thing that could have happened in the wake of the Quran burning incident.
You think it was leadership failure?
I think when I was in Afghanistan, we mitigated combat stress by checking in with me personally, I had my team leaders. Team leaders are basically in the Army responsible for four men. I had them checking with their soldiers and reporting to the squad leaders and then have the squad leader report to me about how they were doing and how they were holding up and could they handle it. And if they needed a break, we left them back on the FOB to take a break. So I think that anytime something like this happens in the Army, it's a leadership failure. Now, whether that leader is at fault remains to be seen, but he certainly, whoever is in charge of this soldier, is responsible.
Well, this soldier has already been diagnosed as being what's called a rare case of having gone berserk. That's actually an old Norse word, but in this case, there's a psychiatrist who said that this is a clinical diagnosis,
yeah.
And in 20 years there have only been two of these patients. But people keep pointing their finger at this Joint Base Lewis McChord, Washington, 45 miles south of Seattle. There have been suicides. There's been charges of PTSD diagnoses going untreated because of cost, and thrill killings that took place back in 2010 in Afghanistan by soldiers from this particular base. Could you see this being the dots being connected here, possibly?
Well, it's interesting that you brought up the word berserk. Dr. Jonathan Shea writes about this in two books called Achilles in Vietnam and Odysseus in America, and writes about the berserk state and how it's possible for soldiers to fall into that. And it's just something I can. It's hard for me to explain, like, what's happening out of Fort Lewis, Lewis McChord. It's hard for me to wrap my mind around really what's going on. You know, I don't really know what to say about it other than it's just so unbelievably unfortunate.
Well, there are a lot of people who are saying PTSD or the Berserk case, trying to give a diagnosis here, and yet President Obama, for example, was very reluctant to accept the analogy that this was anything like the My Lai massacre, Lieutenant Calley killing Vietnamese civilians, and yet it does in many ways parallel that.
It does. I mean, it absolutely parallels. I mean, if in combat, it's so important for you to maintain and stay anchored to your values and your morals, and that's really difficult to do. I mean, you're constantly asking yourself the question, can I maintain my humanity in an environment that is inherently inhumane? And that sort of dynamic runs through the mind and hearts of every single soldier, Marine or airman, who fights in Afghanistan. And it's just, in war, sometimes things like this happen, and it's just, when I hear about it, though, it's just, I feel like this one incident erased an entire year of doing good things for the people of Afghanistan.
There are a lot of other things that diminish doing good things for the people of Afghanistan, though. For example, the competence or lack of it of the Afghan police and the Afghan government's corruption, and certainly the alliance with militant factions in Pakistan.
Sure, yeah. You hit the nail on the head and every point that you just made. I can't dispute that. I think that our strategy in Afghanistan right now, it's the counterinsurgency strategy that's being implemented in Afghanistan right now. The basic premise of it is for, you know, us to train a host nation so that it can secure and govern its people effectively. And calling Afghanistan a nation, because it's so tribal in its nature and in its heritage, calling Afghanistan as a nation is a far stretch of the imagination, let alone a nation that can host another effectively. And so for me, it's like, how can we expect our soldiers to win when the basic premise of the strategy that's being implemented is flawed?
Sean Parnell, so good to have you with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Sean Parnell, again, is a former U.S. Army Ranger who spent 16 months in combat leading group in Afghanistan of soldiers, author of Outlaw Platoon, Heroes, Renegades, Infidels, and the Brotherhood of War in Afghanistan. He joined us from Los Angeles. Let's have our listeners join us. In fact, here's a caller from Arkansas. Tim, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah. How you doing there? What Sean might have said something about is some of these guys that just absolutely want out of this army, for one thing. I mean, what's the history of this fella? I mean, has he tried to get out of the army? Is it just a hopeless?
Well, we know he did three tours in Iraq.
And but, you know, maybe it gets to the point where these guys don't know how to deal with something. But anyway, besides that, the news that comes out, what's happened over there, I'm sure it's been, you know, it's capped, it's looked through and throughout. They try to figure out what, you know, what we're going to end up hearing anyway, as to opposed to, you know, what they could possibly let us know. I mean, things that go on over there, we end up finding, like, WikiLeaks. We sit there and go, whoa, wait a minute, that's not the initial report that we all knew about. It's, you know, later on we find out, oh, well, hey, this is a completely different story. So it's, what is the truth that we hear as opposed to, you know, what they want us to hear and so forth?
Well, Tim, you raise a good point, and I thank you for it. I'm wondering, in fact, again, let me go back to Tommy Mansouri. The Afghan people seem to be convinced, as I said, that this was not one berserk soldier. There were eyewitness accounts supposedly of seeing more than one soldier. And whether that's true or not, that word spreads very quickly through villages, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I would say, responding directly to this fellow who just called in, everybody's idea of Afghanistan, what's going on there, is conditioned by who they're with and who they're talking to. And I find that when I talk to people who are working with training a new Afghan army to take over security, they think it's going well. They think it's really on the verge of success. I've talked to people who have traveled in the Pashtun areas along the border, and amongst other things, they think the Pashtuns of that area are Afghanistan and they should inherit the country. Everybody has, I don't think it's necessarily people are hiding the truth. I think it's like the elephant, and everybody recognizes the little part that they're feeling as being the whole elephant. The word does spread because Afghanistan is connected, Afghans are connected by networks of personal interaction that are invisible publicly. They're not learning about these things just from radio and TV and so forth, but they're talking to their cousins who talk to their cousins, and everybody's connected to everybody. As well, I don't know how many, but a great many Afghans now have cell phones, and word just travels cell phone to cell phone all over the country.
Let me bring another caller on, and that's you, David, from Jackson, Mississippi. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm interested in following up on a comment one of the guests made about the necessity to build a national identity in Afghanistan in order to make the country governable, and later comment about the different ethnicities. There's at least five major different ethnic groups and all kinds of tribal groups. Looking at the history that the United States has had over the last decade in being fairly successful at winning the military operation, but seemingly failing rather abysmally when it comes to doing the national identity stuff and putting the country back together again afterwards, what kinds of efforts are being made in Afghanistan and at this point in time, and have we really learned anything from this last decade?
Could I ask you, Stephen Biddle, to address that since you were talking about national identity?
Well, I think the key issue here is how ambitious do we think we need to be about the construction of a modern state in Afghanistan? The original war aims that the Bush administration entered this with were extremely ambitious and involved a great deal of national identity construction, administrative structure building.
But excuse me, that was an administration that was allegedly, from the beginning, adamantly opposed to nation building.
Ironically enough, and which didn't invest the kind of resources that would be required if you were going to be as ambitious as that. The Obama administration came into office very deliberately dialing back on the scale of ambition, and particularly they were not enthusiastic about the nation-building agenda. What they've been trying to grope their way towards is some minimalist conception of what's required for this country not to be a destabilizing influence in the neighborhood, rather than what's required to develop the economy or the society or the government. Now, for whatever it's worth, many Americans, I think, have this view of Afghanistan as this primitive, ungovernable sort of den of vipers that one can never do anything with at all. Afghanistan was actually at peace internally and with its neighbors for most of the 20th century. It was a very decentralized, economically very underdeveloped state, but not a state that was actively destabilizing its region. I don't think it's hopeless if we're willing to invest the time and the resources, which is a big question right now, to obtain an outcome in Afghanistan that meets this minimalist conception of something that isn't an active source of instability in the region, without necessarily being able to achieve the much larger program of agendas that involve social change, economic change, and political change for its own sake in the country.
Let me thank the caller. Go to more of your calls. First, some web comments. Here's a listener who writes, recently an Afghan said in a BBC interview about the shooter, if he's fit to be a soldier, he's fit to be punished. I agree. But what concerns me about this type of situation is that the media insists that it was a lone shooter. People on the ground are saying it was two men. We've seen the lone shooter spin again and again. No matter what the crisis, the military-industrial media complex always fixates on the lone shooter because they want to pretend they are not connected. It was a bad apple, not a bad system. Obviously, the war-for-profit system, which starts wars based on rumors and lies and fabrications, is the ultimate cause of this tragedy. Another comment on our webpage from Lydia, and you can put your comments on just by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. Lydia writes, a question, how can we send condolences to the Afghan families and community? My first reaction to hearing this and seeing the horror is to reach out to the grieving families and express my sorrow, compassion to them. Might there be an envoy or a way to send a cable via an Afghani-American community agency? And after I do this, I feel more able to discuss policy issues or strategies. Stephen Biddle or Tamim Ansari, any suggestions for this caller, listener?
You know, I don't have a suggestion for how to do it, but I never thought of that, and it strikes me suddenly that a project Afghan Americans might get together here is some way to receive condolences from American people rather than having it come from the government. I think that's a great idea.
Well, we'll put it out there and hope that people will rally around it. There is a big Afghan community certainly here in the Bay Area, and my voice and your voices go far beyond the Bay Area. Another web comment: in our carrot and stick approach to these nations, our carrots are distinctly inferior. Right now, our principal carrot comes in the form of IMF loans, which bring horrific austerity and exploding wealth gaps to nations receiving the so-called aid. That's terrible. Our carrots are repulsive to most nations. Let me go to another caller. And Jack, that's you. Join us. Hi.
Yeah. What type of punishment will happen to this soldier? Does the military typically do death penalty punishment, life imprisonment? And if he's deemed insane, will he just spend the rest of his life in a insane hospital?
Actually, Secretary Panetta has already said the death penalty should be part of what goes forward here. Anybody shed any light on this? Stephen Biddle, can you?
Well, I'm not an expert on the military justice system, but it certainly includes the option of capital punishment. And if this is determined to be premeditated murder, then I think that's the stake that the soldier is looking at.
Well, you know, I mentioned before that there's concern about whether there should be a military justice trial or an Afghan court, and there are many in Afghanistan who feel that the Grand Assembly that was essentially worked on an agreement last November said that more of these kinds of trials should take place in Afghan courts. And it's probably a lesson to remember that shooting of civilians in Iraq by Blackwater affected really everything and led to an unwillingness to give immunity to U.S. service members over there. Stephen Biddle, comment from you?
Well, there are enormous issues of precedent at stake here. I mean, anytime U.S. military forces are deployed anywhere around the world, the question of under whose legal jurisdiction are they going to operate, and if they're brought up on charges in a local court, can they be thrown into a local jail, comes up. The steady position of the Defense Department for generations has been that our troops will be tried in our courts. Now, there are a variety of ways in which concessions can be made to local interests with that precedent retained. For example, often we say crimes committed off-duty or off-post can be prosecuted locally. Crimes alleged to have happened as a property of someone's official duties or on an American installation will be tried by American courts. There are a variety of kind of opportunities for a bit of wiggle room and a bit of concession, but the hard underlying requirement is I don't think the Defense Department or the administration is going to be willing to affect the general precedent that actions undertaken as part of official duty are to be prosecuted when they're criminal in the American system and not the local system.
Well, Kathy Kelly is co-coordinator for Voices for Creative Nonviolence, and we wanted to bring her in here and get her response and reaction. Ms. Kelly, good to have you aboard here. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
First question for you is, we're talking about where this trial ought to be held. Where would you see the best justice to be rendered, in an American military court or in a Afghan court?
Well, I think in the court of public opinion in the United States and in Afghanistan, there has to be consideration as well. I think that it's very important that people try hard to hear the perspective of people in Afghanistan, not only through their juridical system, but after 11 years of being potentially the targets of helicopter gunships flying over their homes, of weaponized drones flying over their homes, of night raids, of slaughters that have happened, of shepherds on mountainsides, of children collecting scrap metal or wood for fuel. We have to hear the rage and the anger, the long simmering fear and discontent, white-hot anger that people feel, because who likes to live under occupation? And if the shoe were on the other foot, had the massacre of 16 people, 9 of whom were children, including a 2-year-old, happened in any city, in any town in the United States, and if the perpetrator of that was an Afghan person, what would the United States people be saying about where a trial would be held?
And what are you saying just in general about what this particular incident, which some are calling, well, a wild card or an outlier type of incident by someone who went berserk, tells us about the occupation or about forces being there?
Well, I think if we're going to say that that person was berserk, then what do we say about all of the military people who've been sent by their government to break down doors, burst into homes in the middle of the night, and start shooting? This is not an exceptional event. This is something that's been part and parcel of United States strategy in Afghanistan. We saw it previously in Iraq. And the night raids are despised all across Afghanistan. And yet the United States is saying, look, this is a non-negotiable in the U.S. position in terms of signing with a Karzai government a strategic partnership agreement. And again, you know, that's not something that's being run past the ordinary Afghan people. It's not even something that's being run past the Afghan parliament. It's the United States pressuring a man who's kind of in the unenviable position of being a quisling, Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, forced to sign on to something the United States wants that will allow U.S. troops, maybe now Special Operations Forces, which are some of the most well-trained warriors and fearsome warriors in the world, to remain in Afghanistan as long as 2024.
Kathy Kelly with us just back from Afghanistan and with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She may, in fact, be sentenced to prison today, along with other peace activists, for protests outside the base. Are your protests having much impact? Do you feel that they're really getting the message across or being heard?
Well, I really must apologize, actually. That sentencing already happened, and we were sentenced to a fine. And to be honest, we don't see ourselves as criminals. We believe we were upholding our duty under international law to speak up about the usage of drone warfare. The weaponized drones that are flown over Afghanistan and Pakistan are in violation of international law, we believe, because there's no way that people can guarantee that their target is a non-combatant, and civilians have been killed and killed repeatedly. Yes, I do think that the discussion about usage of drone warfare is at least beginning to enter into some media circles. The local paper in Syracuse said maybe it's about time in their editorial that the sale of drones were declared illegal worldwide, in other words, calling for a ban or a moratorium, because the proliferation of this new kind of weaponry could create a very, very frightening world, and at least it should be brought up before U.S. people as a matter of discussion. In terms of...
Well, you're doing that. I'm just wondering, though, are you more concerned about the drones or about the occupation and about soldiers, American soldiers being there, and perhaps even more American soldiers going berserk or doing things like urinating on corpses or burning Korans accidentally or otherwise?
But truthfully, I don't separate them. I think that the development of the U.S. military is increasingly moving toward a combination of joint special operations forces and drone surveillance and using drones, remotely piloted aircraft, to fire on civilians in other countries and firing their targeted assassination, I know, is supposed to be taking out people that are considered to be enemies. But I don't separate them. I think it's important to recognize that the soldier who apparently went berserk was assigned to a special operations forces base. It was outside of the main Kandahar base. It was a forward operating base. And this is the direction that the U.S. wants to develop for United States military, and much of it is covert. And it's sort of under the radar, both the drone usage and the special operations forces. And so we have even less control over the United States' addiction to warfare.
And one of the great ironies is that the base that this particular soldier was a village stability operation, we should mention here. And Kathy Kelly, appreciate so much your being with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Kathy Kelly, again, is with Voices for Peace, and was actually just sentenced, Voices for Creative Nonviolence, excuse me, was just given a fine for protesting drone warfare and the war in Afghanistan. Here's a listener who writes on our website, "This soldier may have had a breakdown or entered a berserk state. However, he coldly targeted Afghan families and children in what sounds like a perfectly premeditated mass killing. Seems the only way to placate the Afghans is to let them go through the Afghan legal system, but American hypocrisy in its foreign policy means that Afghan criminals against the United States and American criminals against the Afghans are tried by the U.S. military justice system alike. How should this person be held to account for his egregious acts while respecting the rights of the Afghans to demand justice on their soil? It's a good question. Stephen Biddle, response?
These kinds of issues are always a matter of negotiation between the foreign power and the host government. And that's the case whether there's a war going on or not. The whole issue with the status of forces talks between the U.S. and Iraq recently turned eventually on this question of legal jurisdiction, and the United States decided that it cared enough about legal jurisdiction that it was not willing to concede that in order to retain a presence in Iraq that the U.S. government otherwise thought valuable and wanted to retain. In order to retain the principle that U.S. military on official duties are tried within the U.S. system, we withdrew. I suspect that in Afghanistan as well, it is within the rights of President Karzai and his government to insist that if there are foreigners in their country, they be subject to Afghan justice. It's also our right, if they decide that, to withdraw rather than agree to those terms. My guess is that if President Karzai insists on that, the United States will, as it did in Iraq, probably withdraw rather than break the general precedent that when we have forces deployed overseas, they are subject when on official duty to U.S. Law.
Well, let us leave it there, and we'll obviously continue to watch what's happening in Afghanistan and hope that things will tamp downward. It's been quite disturbing just in the last month or so, and it's disturbing to have an ongoing war. We're out of Iraq, we think, for the most part. We're out of Libya, boots on the ground not there, but we're still very much in Afghanistan and Pakistan, too. I want to thank Laura King, who joined us earlier, Afghanistan Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, Sean Parnell, U.S. Army Ranger, who was with us as well, author of Outlaw Platoon, and Stephen Biddle, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy with the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Military Power, Explaining Victory and Defeat in Modern Battle, and Tamim Anzari, author, lecturer, his latest book, Destiny Disrupted, A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes. We are definitely going to change gears in the hour ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, who believe all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.